Welcome to Electric Evolution with Liz Allen. This podcast is about the journey to a more sustainable future in order for us to be able to do our bit to achieve net zero. I'll be discussing a variety of topics with experts in their field in order to educate and increase our knowledge of clean energy, electric vehicles, and the electric vehicle infrastructure. So whether you're an individual wanting to make a difference at home, a small business, or a corporate, this podcast is just for you. So I'm really pleased to have this guest on today. We have got James Court on the podcast, and James is the CEO of EVA England. James, I'm so pleased. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on and joining me.
No, thank you for having me on, Liz. It's great.
So we, just to kind of give a little bit of background how we kind of got in contact, we basically asked you if we could work on a summary document that you guys have put together, didn't we? And it was the 99% reliability summary that you'd put in a really, really brilliant, concise manner. But we kind of asked you if we could do an infographic, and that's how we got talking, wasn't it? So thank you for allowing us to do that.
No, and thank you for the graphic. I think we've covered that now in every possible way we could. So we've done a sort of an initial tweet, which was sort of the too long, didn't read sort of answer to it. And then we've had the long form blog, and I've just written another 1,200 word piece on it. And then we've got your graphic. So I think we've covered the reliability regs in every way we could, which is good because the government didn't seem to want to push it out. So I think we were one of the few places that were pushing it out, and it was good news. So I don't know why. Yeah, maybe the government woke up and thought, we've got enough good news coming out this Wednesday. Any more would be showing off. So we're going to try and suppress this good news. Yeah, no, it was very
odd. My God. Well, we got it there. We got it out there, didn't we? So let's just talk about some of the stuff that EVA England get involved in. So that was just one tiny, tiny bit. Can we go right back, James? Can we go right back to, obviously you're CEO and I want to bring that into it, but what is EVA England? What do you do, and why was it started?
Yeah, it's a good question because, again, very few EV drivers have heard of us. And I suppose part of that is that we're still a young organisation, started sort of 3 years ago by people who took on, I think a lot of people did take on COVID projects. I didn't learn Spanish or learn how to play the piano or do anything. Yeah, but luckily some people did get some stuff done. So I think there were 7 EV drivers who could see that there were European examples of drivers clubs. So Norway is sort of the North Star. They've got hundred thousand members plus, and they've been around for over a decade and a real sort of influence. And even Scotland had a drivers association, and a well-established one. So it was odd that England didn't have it, but I think there was like a chance encounter between the first chair and the vice chair, and they met at a probably broken EV charging point and thought, we need to do something about this. So they sort of 7 volunteers set up the EVA, and then got some initial funding. I think they launched about 2 and a bit years ago, and then I came on board 18 months ago, just over 18 months ago. And it's been fantastic. I mean, the momentum and sort of the stuff we've already achieved is fantastic. And sort of the sense of that momentum building, I think is really satisfying. I hope certainly to the founder members and the original board. We're sort of ahead of where we thought we'd be in terms of sort of some of the government stuff and the media stuff. It's really satisfying. It's really satisfying. But essentially, we are a advocacy group, a lobbying group, a voice to government and media and industry on behalf of our members and our drivers. I think a lot of people, yeah, it is. It's an unusual organisation, I guess, in the UK. We don't really have these type of lobbying groups. Like everybody's heard of RSPB and sort of National Trust and some of the WWF, those being one, but sort of on specific issues like this, I think we're sort of a bit of an anomaly. So we're not a trade body. We don't represent companies. We don't represent sort of the charging companies or manufacturers. We are 100% representing our members, just regular EV drivers, and people can join us. Yeah, people can join us and they should join us. It's a very small £20 fee. And sort of we try and engage with our members in different ways. And we're definitely going to be doing more of that. But we want to be engaging with members and hearing what they want to say. And then it's up to me to try and push that and push that agenda forward.
And actually, so I joined in on your town hall. So you ran a town hall, didn't you? About a month ago now.
Yeah, and it was the first time we've done it something like that. We've had sort of online meetings before around specific subjects, but actually we're getting to sort of the size and we want to, and we've got sort of the capacity now to start having different ways of communicating with members, where previously it was sort of meeting people fully charged or meeting people in emails, where now, you know, we are surveying members more on sort of specific issues, so the MOT sort of issue and around the charger regs, and we're going to be sending out a new survey in the next couple of weeks so we can get feedback that way, people emailing me directly. But the town hall was a great way of just trying to say for a quick hour at your lunchtime, this is what we've been doing, try and have a guest speaker, and then this is what we want to be doing. What do you want us to be doing? So yeah, it worked really well. And it's been viewed quite a lot of times after as well. The live event, I think we had quite a few people there, and it's sort of multiples of that have been watching it on YouTube and Facebook. So yeah, it's great. I hope the next one, I think we're going to try and get somebody from the charging industry to do a bit of a talk, and whether or not they need the flak jacket and sort of defences, I don't know, but I think we'll try and get one of the good ones, and it'd be nice to hear what some of the plans are from the charging side industry next time.
I was going to say, and there are a few of the good, there are quite a few good ones out there, aren't there? There are some that are a bit poor, and I'm only working this one out myself because, like I say, I've only been driving an EV myself at the point of filming this for about four or five weeks. So, and I've already sussed, it's early days, it's very early days. So yes, I've sussed it out.
I think the learning curve is steep, but it's also quite natural. I found after like 2 weeks, sort of, I began to sort of feel comfortable. And then after a month, it's sort of, all the things you thought you'd worry about, you didn't. But you do learn quite quickly about certain things. We have got a survey out, and I won't go into too much detail. But there is one, and it is sort of, we did ask people to rank their experiences with charge point operators. And I think if I was the industry, it's actually quite satisfying that the companies that drivers instinctively think are good and know are good, and the ones that we think have been putting in the effort, their reviews are really good. And the companies that you can see are behind when it comes to reliability, when it comes to some things like that, they're ranked poorly. So for me, if I was a charge point operator, you can see, actually, if you're running a good product, you are getting rewarded for that. Not everybody thinks charging is all the same. So if I was looking at that, I'd be thinking, good, you know, there are some new entrants there who are challenging Tesla, who are obviously light years ahead. But in terms of satisfaction, some of the people that have come in the last few years are already at sort of Tesla levels of satisfaction. And that's got to be quite a gratifying thing for the CEOs. So yeah, we'll be pushing that out at some point. And again, the usual suspects are at the bottom, and they need to get
there. Well, hopefully they might kind of pull their socks up slightly when they see this. But look, let's just go back a little bit. Reasons why you joined. Obviously, you joined EVA England. So you were working. There was a number of things that I saw when I was kind of looking at what you'd done. But I know you worked for the REA, didn't you? So the Renewable Energy Association at one point. But you've kind of been involved in policy and all sorts of things. So what was it that drew you to EVA England then?
Yeah, so I've always been doing, since I sort of left uni, started working in Parliament and doing environmental stuff, and sort of the politics side of it and the policy side of it's always fascinated me, and I've always been sort of drawn towards that, and always sort of for renewable sustainability type industries. So at the REA, I think we set up the EV group in about 2015. So we sort of represented quite a wide sort of solar panels and biomass and some of the sort of all the renewable technologies, as well as biomass fuels or biofuels, sorry. And it was clear that EVs were becoming, you know, it's weird to think actually that it's only sort of 8 years ago. It was like, these EV things actually might be a thing, you know.
Yeah,
we should probably try. Yeah, we should probably try doing something around that, because quite a lot of our members also, the interface between the energy system and transport had never really sort of come into touch before. So we got involved in 2015, 2016, and that was probably when I started really working on sort of EV policy side of it. And then left the REA and joined sort of various sort of things around even more sort of focused on EVs. So joined the climate group, heading up their EV100 initiative, and that was looking at fleet buyers, so Royal Mail and some of the really big fleet buyers. And that was great, because before that we'd never really had industry, people in suits, people with all their money, talking about electric vehicles and saying, this isn't, you know, we're not sandal wearers, we're Royal Mail, we are big fleet owners, we are transitioning to this, and this is what we need from government to make this transition. We're doing this. So that was great to see that. And then went on to work in the COP unit. I was seconded into the COP unit. So when it's up in Glasgow, heading up some of the transport policy in the Cabinet Office. And that was great, firstly, because I've never seen behind the curtain sort of the civil service side of it. But it was also worked with some of the best people I've ever worked with. Some of the people from Biz and DFT and Number 10 were just so passionate about this agenda. And we'd kind of been given not quite a blank check, but it's so interesting to see the difference between a prime minister, let's say Rishi Sunak, who, whether or not he cares about this agenda, whether or not he sort of supports it or not, he is by no means given sort of the prime minister wants this is the most powerful sort of words for a civil servant. It's like, okay. And Boris Johnson, for all good or ill, on this agenda and on the green agenda was fantastic. And having that sort of support from Number 10 coming down meant that we could really build up and have this sort of whole government approach to it. So the COP was based around, I always forget one, it was cars, cash, coal, trees, cars, cash, coal, trees, and there's another one. Can't remember. I was only working on the cars bit, but the fact that it was sort of the, you know, one of the priorities of government. And again, we had prime ministerial time, we had foreign office time, diplomatic time, and the main ask for our COP presidency was countries, companies, cities, to sign up to a phase out target, preferably 2035, but 2040 for countries, some countries that might struggle to transition that quickly. And we got a great response to it, and we got sort of, I think at the time it was over 30 countries had signed up to it. The EU was still mulling it over. It was just a hugely positive experience and tiring. Anybody that says civil servants are lazy, it was the hours in COP for the 6 months, 8 months leading up to it were insane. And really, sort of the senior time on it, sort of, you're talking, I had a couple of bosses that you'd send an email off at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, and you'd get edits back at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. So you'd be up at 6 o'clock doing the edits, and then the edits would be put back in at night. And it's like, this is, when are you guys sleeping? I'm feeling bad that I seem to sleep. When are you doing it? So when I see some of the comments about the civil service, it's like, no, it was that was full on, and we got a good result for it, which is why it's even more frustrating that we were putting this diplomatic time and effort, prime ministerial time, calling up state leaders saying you need to sign up to this phase out date, and now sort of seeing sort of the ambivalence coming through. We had this global leadership role that we used, and we're sort of squandering it, sort of criminally.
Yeah. I said to you before we started recording, didn't I, that kind of, I would never say I'm a political animal at all, but some of the stuff that has been going on lately has just made my blood boil. It really, really has. You know, you can see all of the effort that everybody's been putting in going to waste just because the leader has decided that actually maybe we need to backpedal on this, you know? And
I mean, it's the not knowing is the most frustrating part, is that I think it's going to go ahead. I think there may be some more concessions. He's definitely got a bit wobbly. Sort of the Uxbridge thing has certainly changed the dynamic. And has become this sort of, which you never wanted it to happen, was this culture war, and it didn't need to be a culture war. And we can sort of see their tactics on this. I think it will backfire. I think people do want to see, you know, strong green policies. I think people want to see it for the environmental reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think people are seeing sort of the change in climate, and even in the blue wall, sort of, I hate it when people think the blue wall, or we've got to really, or red wall, sorry, the red wall, we've really got to dumb down this message. You know, it's a bit like they don't all own whippets and hate foreigners. Like, the red wall also are quite concerned about the climate and their grandchildren and children. So I think, you know, I think they're going to get punished for it. I think Uxbridge was a really specific local issue. Mm. And they've tried to extrapolate that out. And I think they're going to get sort of punished for it. And then the second reason people want it is because they can see that this is where jobs are. They can see that this is where sort of the future is. And I'm sort of talking, especially around the car manufacturers, there is no do-nothing option. The two options you've got as a car manufacturer in the UK is you either prepare to be making EVs or prepare to shut down.
Yes, yes.
Because exactly. Over 70% of our exports are to countries that have a phase-out date. So if you think it's, you know, this thing is happening, and it's going to happen with or without the UK. If we want to have a sort of a car manufacturing base, we need to be transitioning quickly because we are losing ground. And China are throwing everything at this. America have thrown trillions at this. Yeah. The Inflation Reduction Act is pushing this agenda so hard. Like, Biden and sort of the American companies can see this is going to be crucial and we need to do this. The EU are going to be putting together a package, so we could be really left behind, which is, again, criminal considering we were one of the first people to have a mass-produced EV up in Sunderland. Like, we've got experience of this. We have a head start. We've got the skills. We had the political leadership. We've got the investment coming in. If we backpedal on this now, all of that is not only wasted, but is gone. So yeah, I think that the environmental reasons and the job reasons alone, I think most people want this to happen.
So when you were at COP, was that COP26?
Yeah.
So from what I understand, the number of lobbyists or oil and gas, I'm kind of going in a slightly different area on this one, but the number of lobbyists from oil and gas were very low, wasn't it? You know, the numbers at for COP26, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult thing because it doesn't happen. The COP lobbying is a very difficult thing. If you're a single organisation, it's actually very difficult. To try and put it into perspective, you have this huge room where every country attending has their delegation office. And you can physically walk up and knock on doors and say, I want to speak to, you know, your lead. And I did some of this. You knock up to the door and you say, can I speak to your policy lead on this area? And they'll say, yeah, come back in 30 minutes or yes, we can speak now. And you're physically saying, look, this is what we need. I'm from the COP office. You know, this is what we're looking for. Are you happy with this? And this is happening both with governments, but also with other organizations. So WWF have a huge organization, and they are professionals at doing this, and they've got their contacts. And you are trying to build up coalitions. And of course, the oil companies do that, but it's not so obvious. And quite often it's done through countries. So you've got corporate priorities and corporate sort of representation at COP. And then you've got countries, and countries are the ones ultimately in the room trying to debate it. And you have people who are trying to throw spanners in the works, people who are trying to veto it. Just to get into a technical thing, for it to be in the final sort of accord, all countries have to sign up to it. So 193, 4, 6, 7, I forget how many there were.
IPCC was the same, apparently.
This is it. So it's got to be unanimous to be in the final accord. What doesn't need, and what I think was so smart about COP26, is that we then had a bunch of other stuff that weren't actually part of the formal negotiations, the formal negs. We had side targets. So the cars was never part of the official negotiations. It was a separate initiative, which meant you didn't have to have unanimous sort of consent on it.
Yes.
Which meant that you couldn't have these people blocking it. You were either on board or you weren't.
Right.
And you couldn't stop it. And that did highlight, and I think that's a tactic that could be used in future COPs, because not everything has to be done through the necks. And obviously some countries were against this, and they are spread by sort of the country delegations. And I suppose the fascinating thing for us was that we really wanted a certain country to sign up. Mm-hmm. They have lots of manufacturers, some who are ahead in EVs, and some who have banked a lot on hydrogen. So we had some companies from this country that wanted to sign up, but were then told very quickly by the central government, do not sign this as a company, because we're against it as a country, because the manufacturer we are trying to protect, our large manufacturer who's invested in hydrogen. The countries can also have an impact on the businesses trying to sign up.
My goodness.
You can probably, I always forget whether I signed an NDA or not. I don't think I did, but I'm not going to mention the country anyway. But I'm pretty sure that people can guess which country and which manufacturer. But it did have sort of, it did have impacts.
Yeah. But I was going to say, though, that the moving forward to the last COP, was it October 22? Around that?
Yeah.
Wasn't there something like 600 and odd representatives from oil and gas at that COP when there'd been hardly anybody previously? So obviously somebody's kind of put the timer on and gone, wake up, time to wake up, everybody.
Each COP has its own momentum going into it and its own narrative. And Glasgow was, it was set up to be a progressive one. One, it was one of the every 5 years you've got to have. There's an update on the formal side of it, and the last one was in Paris, and then Glasgow was picked of it, and it's a big deal. It's an updating of what you've actually done, as well as negotiations over cash,
right.
In between, COPs can then be sort of hijacked because they're not quite as important. And also, depending on where the country is, depends on what the agenda is. The president sets the agenda. The fact that the two COPs after Glasgow were going to be in big oil-producing countries.
Yes.
You knew the agenda wasn't, this was the last shot for, EVs for a few years, certainly. And some of the big, heavy lifting on it. Now, other COPs have different issues as well. So I think there are huge efforts to try and just transition between the global north and global south. It is natural that some COPs they're not all about sort of the accords and about the cash. Some of them, about the major countries and polluting countries trying to negotiate down. Some of it can be about other issues and sort of balancing up that global south and north, and the sort of what both have to do is important for sure. And trying to get other countries on board is important. But for this particular agenda, Glasgow was a key one, and I think we did a good job.
I think definitely did a good job. But like you said about kind of losing that specific leader, like you said, he also had his there were issues, but he was a voice to be reckoned with, wasn't he?
I thought Alex Sharman was perfect. He doesn't have a huge ego. He wasn't trying to grandstand. He was on top of the detail. I think also we can't sort of downplay the fact that he's of Asian heritage. And I think if we'd have picked sort of a Eton schooled sort of white sort of patriarch, I don't know that's not going to go down very well with the rest of the world trying to take this lecturing tone from sort of almost like a neo-colonialist standpoint. What I think Sharma did really well was meet people on the level and was sort of, again, not having that ego, wanting to speak to every sort of energy minister, environment minister. He would travel to them. He would, you know, he would travel to them for a start. There wasn't sort of the grandeur that I think some people might have feared on a UK presidency, and that sort of hectoring tone, which definitely made a difference. And yeah. he obviously cared. I think he did a fantastic job. He might not be the most sort of electric speaker, but you can't have all of those things. You can't be a huge, charismatic, sort of grandiose politician and then also have the sort of the being humble and sort of going down on that level as well. You've got to pick one of the two, and I think we picked the right character. It took a couple of attempts to get the right president, but I think we got the right one in the end.
It's about that fine line, isn't it? It's kind of just trying to walk the fine line. But if we kind of talk about FUD, so it's funny. Probably 6 months, 6, 9 months ago, I'd never heard of FUD.
Yeah, we've got to be careful because actually people don't know what FUD is.
Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And a lot of that has been going on in the mainstream media, hasn't it, lately? And it tends to be around electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging. So I wanted to just get your thoughts on it, because I know you've been interviewed on TV by various, you know, people on different stations, maybe with an agenda themselves. How the heck do you manage that kind of situation where you're going in and they're kind of guns blazing back at you? You know, how do you actually manage a situation like that to win them over?
Yeah, it's my personality anyway, is trying to convince, but not trying to win an argument. I don't go in there trying to win an argument. I try and go away. My thinking is, okay, obviously this is away territory for me, and people watching aren't necessarily going to be cheering me on or agree. If I can leave at least a couple of salient points to make them think about, that's a win. Not coming across as a sort of sandal-wearing hippie that wants to destroy people's freedoms and sort of want to take us back to the Iron Age. I don't want any of that either. So just trying to come across sort of in a way that perhaps they don't see from this side of the argument that often. And as my partner told me, I've unfortunately my body's been failing. So I used to play good sports like, you know, rugby and football. And then my body has started failing and I've become a nearly middle-aged man playing golf. It's a natural progression for all of us. But I do spend quite a lot of my weekend talking to sort of mini Nigel Farages about this agenda. And, so I've got quite a lot of experience talking. Yeah, I've got quite a lot of experience talking about EVs and the environment to people that don't necessarily agree, and to do that in reasonably respectful and sort of friendly way. I've had quite a lot of practice in that, and I think there's also just a way of, as a lobbyist, you've got to talk to everybody if you can. So I've been a lobbyist for nearly. Coming on to 20 years. And most of that has been in a conservative led government. And I'm sort of not a natural conservative supporter, but I come from a family that were. And it's also part of my job to speak to everyone. So I'm sort of used to that as well. And again, I've got friends who work for the Tories, and friends who sort of don't necessarily agree with everything I say, and I don't necessarily agree with everything they say. And I think trying to think of that down as siloed and trying to think that you're on one side of a battle, certainly on these sort of culture war issues. I just don't see how EVs can possibly be part of a culture war. They're just cars. They've got a steering wheel and four wheels. And they are cheaper to run, and they will be cheaper to buy, and I think they are more convenient, and they're only going to ever get more convenient, and they're fun. We're not trying to, that's the thing I get down to. This isn't a hair shirt strategy. Anybody that's driven an EV really likes them. There are definitely issues when it comes to charging, but that's only going to get better.
Yeah.
And the most convenient way to charge your car is to plug it in at your house overnight. That is so much more convenient than going to a petrol station. And then for people like me who haven't got a driveway, I've got three lampposts within, you know, a minute's walk of me. It's not, you know, it's not as good as having a driveway, but it's still much better than and much cheaper than having a petrol or diesel car. So, yeah, I sort of fall back on the fact that, guys, this is better. It's just better. And, you know, it's fine. It's going to be fine. This is not going to end your world.
No, exactly. And not everybody dislikes them. You know, do they? And it's like...
They're really clutching. I mean, part of me has been surprised in the last 3 to 4 years how bad sort of the dark lobbyists have been. Mm. I've been thinking, God, this agenda's really catching fire. And again, a lot of this was Boris Johnson, especially in this country. And it's very hard for sort of Boris Johnson's natural allies then to sort of come out against it. But even then, I was thinking... I'm surprised at how bad they're lobbying. And then suddenly in the last 6 months, they have kicked on another gear. And sort of we have some idea of where the money is coming from, and it is coming from dark, nasty places. And there is a coordinated, and there is a coordinated campaign being run. That's for sure. And I've got to be honest, it has been brutal and it has been fantastic. Yeah, they have been really good at their job. And you sort of feel at times like that, you're a bit outgunned and definitely out-resourced. So we can do what we can do, and trying to either fudbust or just put together sort of something that most reasonable people will think is reasonable. And I think the papers are going, I hope most sane people can see, like, I think it's getting to the scraping the bottom of the barrel. Like, there's a headline on there's a headline in the paper that was running a week-long campaign, and it was EV users forced to have over 20 apps on their phone. And I'm like, well, firstly, they're not. Secondly, even if they are, if you want to look at the news, I've probably got 15 or 16 different news apps, one of which the paper has an app. There isn't this universal news app. So you're not forced to do it. Very few EV drivers have to do it. It's actually about to become irrelevant anyway, because of all the great work EV have been doing on providing contactless cars.
Yeah.
Even if all of those things weren't true, is that a front page headline? Like, do you ring up like the news desk, hold the front page? Some people have got to have 16 apps on their phone. That's mad. And surely reasonable people can think, like, oh, I think there may be... There was another one today saying mechanics don't want to EVs. And you're thinking, well, again, most sane people will look at that and think, mechanics, you just need to up your game. Like, this is just learn how to do EVs. And secondly, I'd be thinking, why mechanics are wanting us to keep these cars which break down more often? Well, I wonder why that is. Why don't they want EV cars which don't break down as often? It's almost like they've got sort of a different agenda to it.
Ulterior motive. I wonder what that is. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We are definitely facing a huge pushback. And it is part for us. And it is. Yeah, and it's, you know, we do play a role in that. And also we play sort of... There are environmental groups and there are industry groups. There is this coalition of the willing, and we all do try and talk, and we are trying to push out the positive message. And I think we are getting out there, but you know, we are. Yeah, it is a complete onslaught.
It's horrendous, isn't it? So the last two weeks, I think 2 weeks ago there was the EV inverted commas died in a puddle. It wasn't a puddle, was it? And it wasn't even an EV. And I think it
was
about
an EV.
No, I know. Why? What are they doing? And they didn't. And the poor woman on Twitter, because I think I don't know whether she posted it or whether somebody had found it in an old, you know, it was something that had happened previously. They didn't even ask permission to use it. This journalist just decided to post, it was. Everybody who knew about EV, and probably anybody with a bit of common sense, could actually Google, was that car an electric car? I mean, come on.
It had an exhaust pipe on the photo.
It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And then there was another one, and I don't know whether you've seen this. This was about a garage. They were selling cars, and I can't remember which. It was one of the usual media companies, and it said, "We hate EVs because they've shut us down." You know.
Yeah. But then I heard this a lot about, even when electrics were going into cars and the diagnostics were becoming electric in the 90s. And very, you know, if you had a car in the 90s, then you could plug it in, or the mechanic could plug it in, and they would do the electronic diagnostics, which was revolutionary, because before then, yes. you know, you didn't have a way of, you know, you had to do it. And people were campaigning, and, you know, mechanics were campaigning against that and didn't want that to happen. So it's like, okay, if you're a mechanic and you don't have electric diagnostics, you're gonna find yourself shutting down very quickly. Yes. And I think it's the same thing now, is that, you know, you need to upskill. This is the way the world is going, and you can either adapt or die on it. So I don't have that much sympathy on that. I mean, there are definitely going to be, well, I say that, it's really hard to see who the losers are in this. I still can't really think about it. There will definitely still be, by 2050, some petrol and diesel cars on the road.
Yeah.
There will be some really sort of extreme cases where it's hard, you know, are EVs going to be, is an EV going to be possible? It's really hard to think by 2045 how that's still going to be true. But I think this is the point, is that we're only asking for new cars by 2030. Which means that by 2030, between 20 and 30% of cars on the road will be electric. Next year, sort of, this is happening quite slowly. This is not as ambitious as certainly a lot of people in climate and environmental sort of groups wanted. The trajectory that some manufacturers are campaigning against is in fact the business as usual case that SMMT presented to the government. What the growth of EVs is broadly in line with what the industry thought they were going to be doing until 2030. We're just codifying it. We're just making sure it happens. We're giving that very strong message to manufacturers. But more importantly to investors, is that if we want this charging infrastructure to come over, the investors need to know that there's going to be a market. Yes. And at the moment, we have got this investment coming in. £6 billion has already been sort of earmarked by charging companies. That is tangible. We will hit our 2030 charging targets if we continue doing what we're doing. The worst thing we can do, if we delay it by 2 years, that doesn't mean investors are going to delay by 2 years. It means investors are going to run away. And we need this money. And I think that's the second thing on this, is that we are not asking for huge amounts of money from government. In fact, after this current pot, the Levi funding and the rapid charging, it's unlikely that this will need anything more than private sector investment going forward. The case has been made. Most of the money, the vast majority of the money that is going to be needed, is going to be coming from private investment. And that's why the 2030 target is so important.
But what do you think about, so in say, like, am I right, in Sweden, where they've actually provided subsidies for people? Obviously, a few years ago, was it about 4 years ago, there was kind of some money that, you know, £4,000 that you could put towards an EV or some kind of subsidy or something like that. For EVs to come down in price, where do you think we're, because I know we've got price parity, theoretically, what was it about?
With total 20, cost 30? Of ownership and all of that, yeah. Other countries are definitely doing better than us on some of these. I mean, Norway, again, is the example. It would be great if there was still a grant, but actually now I think we're moving, and I think obviously now we're moving to the fairness agenda. I think if you have the money, people are buying EVs. If you have got the money for a new car, the EV option is very attractive. If you are a fleet buyer, the EV option is very attractive. What we need to start doing now is getting more people into EVs. And I think the argument against EVs being expensive is true, but then buying a new car is expensive. Stunningly few people go out and buy a new car. that's mainly 60 to 70% in any given year. It's by fleets. Large fleets are buying 60 to 70% of cars.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is try and pump prime that market so we can get second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand EVs into people, because they are cheaper to run. And that's the frustration, is that you want sort of... especially actually going to the ULEZ issue or going to the fairness agenda, a cost of living crisis, it's sort of how do we get people that need it the most into EVs? And that's some of the stuff that we're going to be looking at in the next 6 months, is how can we get sort of a targeted support to people that could, that sort of deserve to have the EV experience, but may not get it for another 7 or 8, 10 years time until we get those secondhand EV sort of market up and going. So how can we accelerate that? Because I do think that the more we can get people into them, the more this argument just disappears.
I agree. And just to let you know, because I didn't tell you this bit, did I? Our EV is secondhand, so we didn't buy
new.
So you know, yes,
the market is coming. The market is coming because and pre 2019, I think there was a dozen models in the UK. I think last year we're up to over 150. And it was around 2019, 2020 that car makers on the whole, all of them began to have an EV offering. Fleet markets usually take 3 to 4 years to recycle. So we are beginning to see that 2020 car market become secondhands. But even secondhand cars are really expensive, which is why we need to be looking at sort of how can we do... salary sacrifice schemes are fantastic. Sort of is paid before tax and you can save sort of 20 or 40%. That's how I afford it. I would never have been able to afford to run or lease a brand new car. The only reason I can afford sort of the car we've got is because it's on salary sacrifice.
Yes.
And that would be, that's, it's not just affording an EV. I just couldn't have afforded any type of new car. So how can we expand that? I think that's going to be key. And then Octopus EV, have now started salary sacrifice on secondhand cars.
They have. It's a brilliant idea.
Brilliant. So brilliant. So we're going to see some really affordable... the cheapest way to run a car is a salary sacrifice, whether it's EV or not. And you can only get EV on salary sacrifice. So that's the cheapest car you can get is going to be a secondhand EV. Full stop. Full stop. And that's brilliant. And that is going to change, and I hope more sort of innovative thinking around that is going to happen. Things are happening. I think we've just got to, hopefully the government will, they need to have a backbone on it. I think they will lose votes if they go back on it. They're going to lose investment on it. We've just had £4 billion worth of investment from Jaguar Land Rover to build a gigafactory.
Yeah.
And they did that because they thought we were going to have a 2030 target. If we don't, like, that's a huge investment. So I hope that the people arguing against it lose out. It is one of the most frustrating things about our political system, is that if we put 2030 to the vote in Parliament, it would get 600 votes. 600 votes. I'd be amazed if the Antis counted more than 50 votes. All parties agree on it. But because there are a dozen people in the Tory party... that are holding it up, it's suddenly under threat, and it's frustrating when sort of it's certainly not where I think the people are, and it's definitely not where the parliamentary parties are. It's not where industry is.
And like
I don't know who they're listening to. I don't know who they're listening to. They're saying they're listening to industry, and you've got Energy UK, the energy industry, saying we need it. SMMT are saying we don't budge from 2030. Fleets are saying don't budge from 2030, and the charge point operators are all saying don't budge from this. It goes back to that thing that I was saying about 2019. Suddenly we started having people wearing suits and talking business and getting serious, and that was the message that government was getting. It's like, okay, industry and companies are serious about that. We're now at this point where it's like all of the industries I can think of are pro this. So what industry are you thinking of? What is this? I can't think of what industry other than the obvious oil and gas industry.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
This agenda.
Then. Yeah,
I don't know.
But if you think about it, I mean, we both know that oil and gas is massive still, isn't it? You know, and actually they're clinging on by their fingertips to try and, you know, keep this in their grasp. And I get it. You know, I mean, they worked out recently. I'm slightly tangenting. Good word. You know, there was a thing recently about a PR company kind of hyping up heat pumps, wasn't it? The negativity about heat pumps. We knew where that came from. That came from that sector as well, you know. So come on, we've got to be honest about this. We, you know, I'm not saying it to you, I'm just saying it out loud, you know. We've got to know that it's got to be there.
You have the worry is you sound like a conspiracy theorist. I am not a conspiracy theorist. Like, I don't believe in conspiracy theorists. But this is, this isn't a conspiracy theorist. It's just, it's obvious. If you're an oil and gas company, obviously you'd be lobbying against this. I know that, you know, they have lobbyists that are doing this type of stuff. My partner is also, the queen of heat pump Twitter, Clem Cowton. So she's also, we're fighting this on both sides. And it is, you know, it is obvious that what the incumbents are trying to do. So, and it's a difficult thing to fight against, especially if you do, as I say, try and link it into a culture war, which it doesn't, it has no right being any part of a culture war.
And it's got to be, you know, so that the headlines for clicks.
And that's also the second thing. And I don't, when I, this is, so the conspiracy theorists, when they start to lose me, the newspapers are not in on this necessarily. Certainly some may know the PR companies, they may know some of the sources of it, but this is not a coordinated sort of conspiracy. Giles Corrin is not part of this dark web. He just happened to write an article that absolutely took light, and sort of the clicks on it were huge, the most of his career. And then suddenly every newspaper editor was like, oh God, if we mention EVs in a headline, we get loads of clicks.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was just down to that. And then sort of that momentum sort of opened up a campaigning opportunity. And also think Giles Corrin then sold his crap EV car for a good EV car. So the fact that nobody ever mentions that, like, he sort of sneaks in every now and then that he still drives an EV. He swapped it, for a notoriously unreliable car to a notoriously quite good city car.
Right.
So yeah, man ditches crap car for good car isn't quite the story.
It doesn't help clicks, does it really?
That
so,
doesn't, no.
You know.
No. But that certainly did change the tone of debate, because, you know, it did get a huge amount of traction. And he is a very funny writer, and usually I like reading it when it doesn't disagree with my worldview. It's funny that. I really like him when he doesn't write about it, when I agree with him. I really hate it when I do it. I'm sort of aware of my own cognitive dissonance on that.
But you're doing so much to kind of counter all of this anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, and again, we're doing what we can, and that's it. There are sort of coordinated groups, and we all do talk, and we are all sort of there is this coalition of the willing, and we are trying to get it out there, and I suppose spread the resources where we can. So what's the right role for the EVA? What's the right role for Fair Charge? What's the right role for Charge UK? What's the right role for New Automotive? There are lots of groups around that are doing this. So yeah, where do you play? Where's the best place for you to do? What's the best thing for you to do? And there are people behind the scenes who are not sort of necessarily upfront, who are doing huge amounts of work as well. So it is a collective effort. And I think we'll be fine. It's a part of our job. I mean, I've got to be honest. It's sort of on one hand, it's been a satisfying month because we've got our messaging out there and I've got out there, and that's quite nice. But I kind of feel like, but on the other hand, I wish the last 2 months hadn't had this deluge. But it's nice that we sort of, on the one hand, it is satisfying to go out and do it. The things that we much prefer doing, and I much prefer doing, are the things like the charging regs and sort of trying to push a positive sort of agenda through Parliament and trying to get through things through Whitehall. And that's sort of more sort of, it's slightly actually more rewarding because you're achieving positive change. And I think that the charging regs is a really good example, that things are going to get better because of that. And I think the 2030 thing, it would be great if it can get pushed through, and it's sort of, I've been working on it for, God, 3 or 4 different companies now since 2020, so it would be personally satisfying to get it over the line.
Absolutely.
But actually, the charging regs, that was something that the EVA were sort of really key in doing and pushing through, and the added value for members I hope that's going to bring is huge. So yeah, that's sort of the lane I'd prefer to be in, rather than surfing a surfing a tide of shit is not what I really want to do. Even if I'm look, even if you're looking really good surfing on a tide of shit, you're still surfing on a tide of shit.
Exactly.
Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, of course you are. I'm sure people who are listening and watching will not mind.
Yeah, good. I've never said that was a new metaphor that just come to me. Yeah. So I couldn't stop myself from saying it.
Come on, I'm from Yorkshire originally. It's fine. It is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want
so
to just mention...
things will get more normal.
Exactly. Do you want to talk about... So there's a couple of things that's to kind of think about finishing off. Do you want to mention the survey? So you've just actually had a survey. The date's just finished for the survey, hasn't it? And this is for
charges. Yeah, so we closed this weekend. Last survey we did a couple of years ago, we got over 1,000 responses. This year we got over 1,600 responses, which is fantastic. And again, thanks to you and other people who have helped spread it and retweet it. There is a goldmine of information there. I've started going over some of it. There are some really interesting findings.
For charging, this is specifically for charging.
Well, it's for charging, and also there's a bit of policy on there as well, and what people want to see on some of the salary sacrifice stuff, on the VAT, there's stuff about sort of the government policy in it. There's stuff about batteries in it, and there is sort of, there's the general driver experience, but there's a lot of stuff about charging in there as well, and what people want to see and people's experiences of it. It shouldn't surprise anybody that the vast majority of people, over 90% of people, love their EV and wouldn't go back. And, you know, that is quite, I can't think of any other technologies that get that high sort of support. And again, vast majority of people would recommend it to family and friends. Yeah. And I think people saying they would go back to petrol and diesel were minuscule. So.
Good.
Yeah. The proof is in the pudding. Proof, is it?
It is in the pudding. Yes. Yes,
yeah,
it is.
Right. I'm saying that right. I'm just
yeah, you did.
Proof is in the pudding. Yeah.
Did.
Yeah.
Proof
yeah.
is in the pudding. Yeah. 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 If you've made
good.
Your pudding and now you've got to look at your pudding to see what's what proof you've got in it. So that's where your pudding is.
Good.
So that's gonna. So you're going to be
so
disseminating
that.
That's going to
be.
Weeks,
we're going to. Yeah. Months. There's so much information into it. We're going to be disseminating that in the next couple of months because there's so much, and also we've got other things that we're launching. So we are shortly going to be launching our constituency map, which is going to show for every parliamentary constituency how many EVs are there and how many charges are there. So people can click on their own sort of area. And I think if you're in an area that doesn't have great sort of charging infrastructure, definitely something to write to your MP about. And MPs will know what their local patch is. So we're giving that information. So we'll be launching that shortly. And then we've got some policy papers actually expanding on some of the stuff that we've been talking about. So how do we get people who can't afford new cars into EVs? So we'll be launching that policy paper in the next 4 to 6 weeks as well. So we've got a lot of stuff coming out, as well as more deals and hopefully member discounts that we can announce. We're always on the lookout for member discounts. We love a good member discount. So we've got some new ones coming down the line. And yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting. And again, changes to the website, more blogs. We've got a great events page now, so I think we can. If there's an EV event nearby, let us know, and we can put it on our event, and that gets a lot of views. So it's all it's all happening. It's all quite exciting. Not having that much of an August off because everything's coming to a head. Yeah, everything's coming to a head overall in August, which it was terrible planning by me. But by the looks of it, I'm not really missing much of a summer anyway. So.
No, I agree. I think we're not. Neither of us are missing very much because it's all been a bit pants this month, hasn't it? Really?
Yeah.
You know.
A little bit. So you know, but what better? What better use of my time than
exactly
than continuing this.
So for those who are interested in finding EVA England, it's evaengland.org.uk.
Yep.
On t'internet. So James.
And we've got Yeah, and we've got Twitter, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and I think also if you're a Nexus member or a, there are certain groups that we've got a discount code for, so look on, if you're on an EV group or an EV forum on Facebook, have a look and see if you're one of the groups that are signed up to it, and we've got discounts for them. So yeah, it's...
I'm now a member, so I'll be looking at the member discounts.
Yeah, and you also get a wonderful newsletter letting everybody know what's going on in the industry and more recently what's been going on in Parliament. So yeah,
that's good. And I can see you're also
£20 a month. What's £20 a month? £20 a month. God, £20 a year.
A year, exactly.
I mean, I think £20 a month. I think £20 a month is still a bargain. But no, yeah, £20 a year.
I know exactly. That's good. I can also see you're on Instagram as well. So what I'll do, I'll make sure that everything, all of your links and everything are in the show notes when this goes live. So just to say, just keep doing what you're doing. You're an absolute star. Honestly, I can't just, I can't tell you.
I should be on the, I felt at times like therapy, actually. I should have been on the couch, sort of venting. But no, this has been really good fun.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Well, listen, James, thank you ever so much.
Thank you.
It's been brilliant. So I hope everybody else has enjoyed watching and listening to it. So please do get in contact with James. Have a look on the EVA England website. The only way we can move this forward is by moving forward together.
And it makes a difference. Every member sort of grows our strength and helps our capacity to help fight this stuff.
Do it. And £20, come on, you know?
Come on. It's nothing.
Cheap as chips, that, isn't it, really? Yeah. On that note, I'm going to go now. I'm going to say thank you to James. I'm going to say thank you to you all for watching and listening. And I shall see you next time. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Electric Evolution with Liz Allen. If you want to find out more about Full Circle Continuous Improvement, please visit us at www.fullcirclecl.co.uk. Don't forget to keep listening for more episodes coming up really soon.